rather small and beleaguered community that works on stratospheric aerosol injection. They have a different model in which if you only put half the amount of sulfur dioxide in the stratosphere that would be required to cancel all of this year's warming, you don't move the rainfall around. It stays where it is. Okay, so you lost half the effective cooling that you might have got if you could go full speed ahead. But you leave the rainfall where it is, including the monsoons and the whole question of moving the intertropical convergence zone, the band either side of the equator, moving rainfall there north or south and leaving a whole bunch of people stranded in what suddenly becomes desert, has been dealt with. You know, the number of people I hear still quoting the old story is about half of the total climate scientists I've talked to. I mean, you talk to anybody who's working on the stratospheric aerosol injection, and they know we fixed that about 5 years ago in the models. Everybody else still quotes it. I don't know why they don't read the journals.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Alex talks with journalist Quint Dyer about his new book, Intervention Earth, Life-Saving Ideas from the World's Climate Engineers.
Well, I just spoke with scientist Wolfgang Kramer, formerly with the Potsdam Institute, now a professor in France, and he thinks attributing the Syrian civil war or the Arab Spring to climate-driven drought sounded good at the time, but fails on deeper inspection of other causes. In his view, we have not seen a war where climate change is the distinctive driver. I'm wondering, as you've been working on this for years, what do you think a future climate war might look like?
I don't actually have a very clear view of that, because my view is more that while there may be climate elements involved and great turbulence and violent clashes and so on, it's very hard to draw up a scenario for a climate war. I mean, I was trying to do that because I thought everybody thought it was likely to be a consequence when I did the first book, and I'm actually less concerned about that than I used to be, which is not to say unconcerned, but it's really hard to draw up a scenario, a plausible scenario, one you can believe yourself at least, in which people go to war over climate. I can almost make one between India and Pakistan, because there's a very peculiar geographical thing there, which is Pakistan depends almost entirely on one big river running through the desert for about 65 or 70% of all its food production, but India controls the headwaters of that river. There's a few others, like the Nile, which are also where the headwaters are controlled from different countries than downstream. And if it stops raining up in the highlands of Ethiopia, which is where most of the water in the Nile comes from, and the Ethiopians decide they're going to hold on to what they've got because they can't, you know, otherwise their agriculture suffers, the Egyptians would take that very badly, I think. But actual wars over that, wars over water have occurred, but wars over climate is a bit harder to make concrete. I think the bigger source of wars is likely to be waves of refugees or waves of people who are trying to escape the catastrophes that await them and will produce refugees, moving from those countries into other countries. And, of course, that's mostly moving away from the equator, which is where the worst effects will be felt soonest. And so it just sort of compounds the existing migration tendency out of poor countries into rich countries. But it's very hard to get a war out of that. It's you can get huge amounts of human misery out of it. You can get radicalization politically in the sort of host countries or the countries that don't want to be hosts of this migration out of it. But a proper war with, you know, cities being bombed and things like that, I honestly don't think so. One of the reasons I don't think so, and this is a bit crude, the countries that are desperate and whose citizens are trying to get into the rich countries, because that's also the safer countries, at least in the short run, from climate change, are generally also militarily much weaker than the rich countries. So war is not an effective resort for them, and they don't have the means to hit the rich countries safely very hard. The refugee problem is huge. I mean, I'm just waiting. I've been looking at the temperatures in South and Southeast Asia in the past few months. I look at them almost every day. And you're looking at areas right across from Pakistan to the Philippines now. And this is the peak heat season in most of that area, sort of April to June. I went on the weather report from the Indian Meteorological Department for one day, and it was 42 degrees here, 43 degrees here, there, 45 degrees over there, all across northern and central India. Not the far north, not in the Himalayas, but the whole of the Indus Valley, the whole of the Ganges Valley, and all the territory going south from there down to about Karnataka and places like that, two-thirds of India in population or more, is suffering between 42 and 45 degrees day after day after day. They closed the schools for 2 weeks in Bangladesh because it was too hot for the kids to go to school this spring. So that's where the stuff is going to get bad quickly. And that's where the refugees will be generated. And that's just going to have to be dealt with in various ways. And some of them may be quite ugly in terms of borders slamming shut. And you can shut borders. All you have to do is be willing to kill people trying to cross them, and quickly people stop trying to cross them. But nobody wants to do that, so there's other, you know, desperate searches for other solutions, none of which are very effective. But getting a war out of it? Not really. I've lost a lot of my concern about that. I have bigger concerns, frankly.
And your new book title, it speaks of intervention and of life-saving ideas. Are we talking really about geoengineering, or are there other ideas that you came when you interviewed with your many scientists?
No, I mean, the conclusion I'd reached by the end of the first book, and which I started with already at the beginning of the second book, the one that's just out now, The Intervention Earth, is that we have left it too late, and it was probably inevitable that we would leave it too late to solve this problem with emission reductions or ending emissions, which is really the goal, alone. That is not any longer an option at all. It's not available. Given the demonstration of how slowly we act on these matters politically, you can imagine that we might begin acting a little bit faster or even a whole lot faster once people start to die in large numbers, and particularly once people start to die from major climate disasters in the developed parts of the world, which is where the changes have to happen in terms of where the emissions are mostly coming from. But I do not see any way that you are going to be able to, let us say, speed up fivefold the rate at which you are cutting emissions. Well, let's be generous. Let's imagine we're cutting emissions now. We're not. But suppose we're cutting emissions at 2% a year now. Be nice, rather than putting 2% more in every year, which is what we're actually doing. How fast are you going to be able to accelerate that? Given that it is human beings, human governments, human political parties, human everything who are making these decisions, how fast are you going to be able to go to 4% or 8% per annum cuts? You know, come on.
What are you doing these days? Are you planning to continue this long work of yours?
I don't see how I could stop. Do you? I mean, it's going to swallow everything else up, this issue. finally, it's actually getting something like the exposure it should have had 20 years ago in terms of the gap between the research and the public knowledge, or effective public knowledge which might guide sensible decision-making. And I'm a journalist. What else am I going to be doing at this time?
From London, we've been speaking with military expert, author, and longtime journalist Dr. Gwyn Dyer. His television and radio series are legendary. His new book is Intervention Earth, Life-Saving Ideas from the World's Climate Engineers. Find out more in my show blog at ecoshock.org and check out www.gwyndyer.com. Gwyn, thank you for spending this time with our listeners.
It was a pleasure, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org.
They said the danger line was 1.5 degrees C, warmer than pre-industrial. During the last 12 months, Earth was 1.65 degrees C hotter. Nobody can explain why. Gwyn Dyer published his take on May 12, 2024, suggesting, quote, unprecedented warming could be ocean feedback. Dyer continues, this leaves us with the least desirable explanation. The heating humans already have caused carries us across a tipping point we cannot see and unleashes a feedback, warming from non-human sources that we cannot turn off, end quote. When it comes to solar radiation management, even some cloud scientists are unsure. The seemingly less intrusive plan of large-scale deployment of spray to brighten clouds, will it work? Hear from University of Utah's atmospheric scientist Tim Garrett on Radio EcoShock way back in November 2010. Well, recently I recorded a speech by the former Whole Earth catalog guru, Stuart Brand. He calls for an all-out effort to geoengineer the planet to stave off a climate disaster. He likes the idea of making clouds brighter by shooting seawater into them. That's supposed to reflect more sunlight, hoping to cool the Earth. You are a scientist with expertise in clouds. What do you think about that?
I'm quite skeptical that that would work. I mean, geoengineering is, in some sense, it may be a question not whether we should do it, but perhaps when we will do it. Because one could imagine that civilization will always try to do whatever it can to optimize its capacity to grow. But with regards to brightening clouds, well, that's been suggested as perhaps a viable way of doing it. One popular way that's been suggested is to produce lots of sea spray from some fancy ships. This sea spray goes up into the clouds, and that makes them brighter because if there are lots of small aerosol particles, these sea salt particles, then there will be more droplets in the clouds and also smaller droplets. And that has two effects. One is that, for some reasons I won't describe, it makes the clouds brighter. Just by having a large number of small droplets, you have brighter clouds and clouds that have a small number of large droplets. But it also tends to shut off precipitation in the clouds. And because precipitation is a sink, it's a means for losing water from clouds, it has been argued that the clouds will have longer lifetimes and therefore reflect more sunlight to space for a longer period of time. And because they're brighter, they'll reflect more. These ideas have been around since the 1970s and 1980s. And it has since become apparent to a lot of researchers in this area that the effect is not nearly as strong as one might initially expect. There are all sorts of, again, negative feedbacks. And these negative feedbacks often act to entirely erase the brightening effect that you might expect from these aerosols going into the clouds. I mean, just to give one example, the clouds that would be targeted are these large sheets of stratus clouds that and stratocumulus clouds that are off the western coasts of continents. So where you are, I guess you're in Vancouver, are you? You're probably very familiar with low-level clouds. I used to live in Seattle, and it was, you know, in Seattle, it's the entire winter was covered with this large deck of low-level clouds. Now, these clouds, if we brighten them, then they tend to be over the ocean. If we brighten them, then less solar radiation comes in to heat up the surface. And it is warming of the surface that enables the fluxes of moisture and heat from the oceans and the surface upwards into the atmosphere that enable the clouds to form in the first place. So let's say the clouds become brighter, they cool the surface, then there's less flux of heat and moisture to form the clouds, and then the clouds dissipate. So it could be that adding aerosols to clouds does not make them brighter and more long-lived, but actually shorter-lived and darker.
That was Tim Garrett on Radio EcoShock in 2010. Find links in my blog. You may want to listen to several other interviews in the EcoShock archives about geoengineering, both pro and con. For example, in June 2020, I talked with Abba Lou Abatayo, an economist and research fellow at the prestigious Bocconi University in Italy. Her new study says solar geoengineering may lead to excessive cooling and high strategic uncertainty. Again, links in my blog. And check out the show Fixing the Climate, Hopes and Hazards, posted February 2nd, 2022, with Wake Smith. His book is Pandora's Toolbox, The Hopes and Hazards of Climate Intervention. It is a full meal, investigating many aspects. In the book, Wake says, quote, "I think there would be demonstrations around the globe, on a scale quite literally never seen before, to demand further action. I can imagine riots that may coalesce into widespread armed insurrection as tens, if not hundreds, of millions of people watch their homes claimed by the sea and their crops wither. The members of the new greatest generation would not then meekly return to their desiccated farms and watch their children starve. That just doesn't seem plausible. The world would demand more." End quote from Wake Smith. Wake recommends the 2021 report by the National Academy of Science titled Reflecting Sunlight, Recommendations for Solar Geoengineering Research and Research Governance. As it stands, if Wake Smith could somehow magically deploy solar intervention, he is not ready to do it. Instead, he offers his expertise on what a program could look like if it was ever needed. Others strongly disagree with geoengineering, like previous Radio EcoShock guest Clive Hamilton, and probably every environmental group there is, especially the ETC group. And of course, if you do create more clouds, that triggers the chemtrails conspiracy of spraying for mind control. That is also covered by Radio EcoShock. In January 2022, about 200 scientists called for a halt of testing of geoengineering. Find that letter and an article about it linked in my show blog at ecoshock.org. New science out in May 2024 in PNAS suggests recent heat waves in the North Pacific may be triggered by an air pollution cleanup in China. The paper title is Atmospheric Teleconnections from Abatement of China Aerosol Emissions Exacerbate Northeast Pacific Warm Blob Events. This furthers arguments by James Hansen and Leon Simons that cleaning air pollution on land and in ocean freighters reveals previously hidden energy and heat in the system. Another new paper in May, this time in Geophysical Research Letters, warns solar geoengineering could result in unexpected regional heating. The title is Side Effects of Sulfur-Based Geoengineering Due to Absorptivity of Sulfate Aerosols. The authors conclude stratospheric aerosol intervention could cause regional changes as bad as carbon dioxide.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
American scientist Alan Robach contributed to our survival when he published his work about nuclear winter. Essentially, even a limited nuclear war would put so much dust and debris into the atmosphere, the surface would go dark for as many as 10 years. Most plant and animal life would die. That is why nuclear war cannot happen. Everyone loses, no matter who launched and who was hit. Alan Robach then published about geoengineering, specifically those methods that inject either salty water or sulfates into the atmosphere. We discussed that in a 2015 interview that still works very well today. Here's an excerpt. And then looking at your graphs with the Arctic experiment, it looks like global mean temperatures go right back up to where they would have been within a decade or two of stopping injecting those aerosols into the atmosphere. Why would we stop once we start?
Well, that's true of any such scheme. Imagine you start doing geoengineering and there's a big drought in China or floods in India, and they say, you damn geoengineers, you're causing this. We demand that you stop it. And you say, well, there's natural variability. You can't prove that this flood or drought wouldn't have happened anyway. They say, we don't care. We think you're doing it. Stop. And so it would be very difficult to continue doing it in the light of that. And so I can imagine that society would lose the will or the means to do it. Or some other catastrophic weather event happened, and whether or not you could connect it to the geoengineering, people would connect it and demand that it be stopped.
So, Alan, in the end, do you think we will become so desperate or so wedded to fossil fuels that we really will inject pollution into the sky to block the sun?
So I'm a good weather forecaster. I'm not such a good forecaster of human behavior, but right now I think no. I think the governance aspect will not be soluble. How do we set the planetary thermostat? How do we decide what temperature we want the planet to be? Nations where it's cold, like Canada, Russia, maybe in the U.S., wouldn't mind a little bit of warming because you could exploit the Arctic. But islands that are drowning in the tropics right now would like it to be even cooler than it is now. I don't know how we could decide how to manage the planet.
As we wrap up, I've always thought of nuclear weapons as a sign of basic insanity in the human race, and now we want to control the climate, the weather, and the rain with the same mentality. I'm wondering if we should add basic human insanity to your list of reasons why geoengineering may not be such a good idea.
Well, Donald Rumsfeld is right about one thing. There are unknown unknowns, and so we don't really know what we don't know about what would happen. I mean, would you trust the whole world to this one technical solution? I mean, anybody who is in a car today and had the seatbelt on understands this concept. Anything made by humans and operated by humans can not function, can break or be operated poorly. And so that's one of the reasons why it would be very scary to try and control the whole world on purpose like this.
From New Jersey, we've been speaking with the Distinguished Professor of Climate Science at Rutgers University, Dr. Alan Robach. You can hear that full interview with Alan Robach using links for this show at ecoshock.org. It is worth your time. In another presentation, Robach summarized 20 reasons why geoengineering might not be a good idea. Here is his quick point list.
1. Regional climate change, including temperature and precipitation. 2. Continued ocean acidification. 3. Ozone depletion.
4. Effects on plants of changing the amount of solar radiation and partitioning between direct and diffuse. 5. Enhanced acid precipitation. 6. Effects on cirrus clouds as aerosols fall into the troposphere.
7. Whitening of the sky but nice sunsets. 8. Less solar radiation for solar power, especially for those requiring direct radiation. 9. Rapid warming when it stops.
10. How rapidly could effects be stopped? 11. Environmental impacts of aerosol injection, including producing and delivering aerosols.
Unknowns. 12. Human error. 13. Unexpected consequences. How well can we predict the expected effects of geoengineering? What about unforeseen effects?
14. Schemes perceived to work will lessen the incentive to mitigate greenhouse gas emissions. 15. Use of the technology for military purposes. Are we developing weapons? 16. Commercial control of technology.
17. Violates UN Convention on the Prohibition of Military or any other hostile use of environmental modification.
18. Could be tremendously expensive. 19. Even if it works, whose hand will be on the thermostat? How could the world agree on the optimal climate? 20. Who has the moral right to modify the global climate?
Those 20 reasons why geoengineering might not be a good idea came from scientist Alan Robach at Rutgers. Links in my blog. Meanwhile, from MIT, published in 2022, the U.S. government is developing a solar geoengineering research plan. According to CNBC, quote, the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy is coordinating a 5-year research plan to study ways of modifying the amount of sunlight that reaches the Earth in order to temporarily temper the effects of global warming. End quote. Scientists have proposed a metric for the amount of SRM required and for how long for a particular amount of warming. This was proposed in 2013 as a degree year, which, quote, quantifies the magnitude of solar radiation management that would be needed to keep global temperatures under a given threshold, end quote. There's a real push for this stuff, a lot of research. I mean, for fallback steps nobody wants to take, there's a lot of action on the geoengineering front. The Union of Concerned Scientists is opposed to deployment of solar geoengineering, but it supports more modeling and research. So does the Environmental Resources Defense Council. Meanwhile, Harvard, UCLA, and the Paris Peace Forum have convened a group called the Climate Overshoot Commission. The European Union's chief scientific advisors released a scoping paper on solar radiation modification in August 2023. As superheat waves manifest on both land and sea, calls for SRM research will just get louder. Personally, after some painful thought, I think research on solar management should go ahead, just the research. Keep in mind, even experts like David Keith and Ken Caldera said the tests could take a decade or more to evaluate, that is, to know if any of the proposed techniques work. They say, quote, tests would require several decades or longer to obtain accurate response estimates, particularly to understand the response of regional hydrological fields, which are critical uncertainties, end quote. They are talking about disturbances to rain patterns that could damage or crush agriculture with drought or floods or both. Some say every weapon ever discovered was used, and likewise, if we research and develop SRM, some government or billionaire will deploy it. But is that true? Not every country that could build a nuclear weapon did so. Think about Japan, probably South Korea, and likely Iran, that have gone to the edge of having materials and the ability to make a nuclear weapon, but have not done so yet. Just studying solar radiation management does not guarantee it will be used, but it might put such a tool into easier reach for desperate politicians with less time lag. The road to climate hell has two components. First, plans for more fossil fuel extraction announced by industry and governments go ahead. Second, geoengineering, like solar radiation management, contains the resulting emergency of heat as we continue to pollute. Solar radiation management does not limit warming in any way. It just masks the reality. It stalls it. The technology becomes the largest and most deadly addiction yet. If we go that route, humans could not stop purposely polluting the atmosphere, even for a little while. The attempt to control cannot afford to fail, or all will be revealed, the sunset of the species in full advance into hothouse Earth. We cannot have our cake and eat it too. If we try, the cake eats us. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
Too hot. Way too hot. Crops dying. People dying. Cool it down. Whatever it takes. They said turn down the sun. Cool it down. Never mind tomorrow. Gotta cool it down. Today, the climate engineers study the last days, engaging our fears of changing our ways. They said we can't make the cut, turn down the sun no matter what. Fix it. Ooh.